Good morning. This is Robert Carey speaking to you from the new Senate office building in Washington, D.C. This is National Public Radio coverage of the hearings and deliberations of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee dealing with legislation to end the war in Indochina and associated bills. There is but one witness on the list this morning. He is John Kerry. Mr. Kerry is with the group Vietnam Veterans for Peace, a group which was here in profusion for the opening of the hearings for the testimony of Senators Hatfield and McGovern on Tuesday morning when this current round of hearings began. They are here again this morning in great numbers. There are about 200 people outside this hearing room who are not able to gain admittance. The hearing room is at this moment crowded to absolute capacity. There are many members of the Vietnam Veterans for Peace group here in fatigues and army uniforms in various states of disrepair and sort of unofficial uniform. They have filled to absolute overflowing all of the spaces set aside for the public. There are also several members of the Capitol Security Force here to make sure that this group will not be quite as vocal in their appreciation of some of the testimony to go forward this morning as they were the other morning with Senator George McGovern and Senator Mark Hatfield. They were quite responsive to several of the suggestions and answers to questions that those two senators, the authors of one of the bills under consideration in this committee, the Vietnam Disengagement Act, Senate Bill 376, when the senators who are co-authors of that bill spoke on it, the veterans were very vocal in their response. This is the third day in the current round of hearings. The hearings began on Tuesday morning with testimony, as was said, by Senator George McGovern and Senator Mark Hatfield. Senator McGovern was the first witness to appear before the committee, and following his prepared remarks, the veterans group in the room gave out a shout of "Right on, brother," and then a full minute of applause. Senator Fulbright gaveled down the noise, but as he has been with the four or five minor incidents that we've had breaking the quiet of the room, he was rather firm but very tolerant. McGovern was testifying before this committee on behalf of Senate 376, the Vietnam Disengagement Act of 1971, and he, in his prepared remarks, reiterated several times the necessity, in his view, of a definite commitment to a date for total withdrawal and cessation of hostilities in Vietnam. He made reference through his remarks to several possible alternatives in accomplishing the end of the war, and among them he listed candidacy in opposition to President Nixon in next year's election. That is a path, of course, which the senator has already chosen. However, he said that the country could not wait until 1973 for a solution, and so the ending date right now on the bill as it stands for a pullout, a withdrawal, and a total cessation of hostilities is December 31st, 1971. Senator Fulbright has just entered the hearings chamber. He's seated in the chairman's position on the bench. Senator Jacob Javits of New York is here. The full committee has not been present for any of the hearings. There have been as many as six senators on the bench at one time. We see Senator Javits from New York today back on the bench as a member of the committee. Yesterday morning, he was seated at the witness table and testifying to his support of Senate 376. Senator Javits had one alteration that he said he would like to see in the bill, and that was to move the date of termination of the Indo-Chinese involvement from December 31st, 1971 to June 30th, 1972. Many photographers are now gathered around the chairman's position as Mr. Kerry, our witness this morning, is standing before the bench in front of the witness table, having a short and it looks like a cordial conversation with the chairman. Mr. Kerry moves to the side of the bench now and is greeted by Senator Javits of New York. Now Mr. Fulbright has grasped the gavel. There is a rule of absolute silence in the room while the committee is in formal session, and so we rely upon the chairman to identify those who speak.
Will the committee come to order? The committee is continuing this morning its hearings on proposals relating to the ending of the war in Southeast Asia. This morning, the committee will hear testimony from Mr. John Kerry, and if he has an associates, we'd be glad to hear from them. These are men who have fought in this unfortunate war in Vietnam. and I believe they deserve to be heard and listened to by the Congress and by the officials in the executive branch and by the public generally. You have a perspective that those in the government who make our nation's policy do not always have, and I'm sure that your testimony today will be helpful to the committee in its consideration of the proposals before it. I'd like to add simply on my own account that I regret very much the action of the Supreme Court in denying the veterans the right to use the mall I regret that. It seems to me to be but another instance of an insensitivity of our government to the tragic effects of this war upon our people. I want also to congratulate Mr. Kerry, you and your associates, upon the restraint that you've shown, certainly in the hearing the other day when there were a great many of your people here. I think you've conducted yourselves in the most commendable manner throughout this week, which I'm sure whenever people gather, there's always a tendency for some of the more emotional ones to do things which are even against their own interests. But I think you had deserved much of the credit, as I understand you are one of the leaders of this group, and I have joined with some of my colleagues, specifically Senator Hart, in an effort to try to change the attitude of our government toward your efforts at expressing and bringing to this committee and to the country your views about the war. And I personally don't know of any group who would have both a greater justification for doing it and also a better, more accurate view of the effect of the war, which, as you know, there has grown up in this town a feeling that it's extremely difficult to get accurate information about the war, and I don't know a better source than you and your associates. So we're very pleased to have you and your associates, Mr. Kerry. And at the beginning, if you would give to the reporter your full name and a little of your briefly, your biographical attitude so that the record will show that clearly.
I was down there to your encampment yesterday, saw the New York group. I just would like to say that I'm very proud of the deportment and general attitude of the group. I hope it continues. As a lawyer, I hope that I've joined in the Hart resolution too. I hope you will find it possible to comply with the order, even though, as the chairman says, he's unhappy about it. But I think it's our job to see that you are suitably set up as an alternative so that you can do what you came here to do. And I welcome the fact that you came and what you're doing.
You have a seat, Gary.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Fulbright, Senator Javits, Senator Symington, Senator Pell. I would like to say for the record that, and also for the men behind me who are also wearing the uniform and their medals, that my sitting up here is really symbolic. I'm not here as John Kerry. I'm here as one member of a group of 1,000, which is a small representation of a very much larger group of veterans in this country. And were it possible for all of them to sit at this table, they would be here and have the same kind of testimony. I would simply like to speak in very general terms. I apologize if my statement is general, because I received notification yesterday you would hear me, and I'm afraid because of the injunction I was up most of the night and haven't had a great deal of chance to prepare. I would like to talk representing all those veterans and say that several months ago in Detroit, we had an investigation at which over 150 honorably discharged, and many very highly decorated veterans testified to war crimes committed in Southeast Asia. Not isolated incidents, but crimes committed on a day-to-day basis with the full awareness of officers at all levels of command. It's impossible to describe to you exactly what did happen in Detroit, the emotions in the room, the feelings of the men who were reliving their experiences in Vietnam. But they did. They relived the absolute horror of what this country, in a sense, made them do. They told the stories of times that they had personally raped, cut off ears, cut off heads, taped wires from portable telephones to human genitals and turned up the power, cut off limbs, blown up bodies, randomly shot at civilians, razed villages in a fashion reminiscent of Genghis Khan, shot cattle and dogs for fun, poisoned food stocks, and generally ravaged the countryside of South Vietnam, in addition to the normal ravage of war and the normal and very particular ravaging which is done by the applied bombing power of this country. We called this investigation the Winter Soldier Investigation. The term Winter Soldier is a play on words of Thomas Paine's in 1776 when he spoke of the sunshine patriot and summertime soldiers who deserted at Valley Forge because the going was rough. And we who've come here to Washington have come here because we feel we have to be winter soldiers now. We could come back to this country and we could be quiet. We could hold our silence. We could not tell what went on in Vietnam. But we feel because of what threatens this country, the fact that the crimes threaten it, not reds and not redcoats, but the crimes which we're committing are what threaten it. And we have to speak out. I would like to talk to you a little bit about what the result is of the feelings these men carry with them after coming back from Vietnam. The country doesn't know it yet, but it's created a monster. A monster in the form of millions of men who have been taught to deal and to trade in violence, and who are given the chance to die for the biggest nothing in history. Men who have returned with a sense of anger and a sense of betrayal which no one has yet grasped. As a veteran and one who feels this anger, I'd like to talk about it. We're angry because we feel we have been used in the worst fashion by the administration of this country. In 1970, at West Point, Vice President Agnew said, "Some glamorize the criminal misfits of society while our best men die in Asian rice paddies to preserve the freedoms which those misfits abuse." And this was used as a rallying point for our effort in Vietnam. But for us, his boys in Asia, whom the country was supposed to support, his statement is a terrible distortion from which we can only draw a very deep sense of revulsion, and hence the anger of some of the men who are here in Washington today. It's a distortion because we in no way considered ourselves the best men of this country, because those he calls misfits were standing up for us in a way that nobody else in this country dared to. Because so many who have died would have returned to this country to join the misfits in their efforts to ask for an immediate withdrawal from South Vietnam. Because so many of those best men have returned as quadriplegics and amputees, and they lie forgotten in Veterans Administration's hospitals in this country, which fly the flag which so many have chosen as their own personal symbol. And we cannot consider ourselves America's best men when we were ashamed of and hated what we were called on to do in Southeast Asia. In our opinion, and from our experience, there is nothing in South Vietnam, nothing which could happen, that realistically threatens the United States of America. And to attempt to justify the loss of one American life in Vietnam, Cambodia, or Laos, by linking such loss to the preservation of freedom, which those misfits supposedly abuse, is to us the height of criminal hypocrisy. And it's that kind of hypocrisy which we feel has torn this country apart. We are probably much more angry than that, and I don't want to go into the foreign policy aspects because I'm outclassed here. I know that all of you have talked about every possible alternative to getting out of Vietnam. We understand that. We know that you've considered the seriousness of the aspects to the utmost level, and I'm not going to try and deal on that. But I want to relate to you the feeling which many of the men who've returned to this country express. Because we are probably angriest about all that we were told about Vietnam and about the mystical war against communism. We found that not only was it a civil war, an effort by a people who had for years been seeking their liberation from any colonial influence whatsoever, but also we found that the Vietnamese, whom we had enthusiastically molded after our own image, were hard put to take up the fight against the threat we were supposedly saving them from. We found that most people didn't even know the difference between communism and democracy. They only wanted to work in rice paddies, without helicopters strafing them, and bombs with napalm burning their villages and tearing their country apart. They wanted everything to do with the war, particularly with this foreign presence of the United States of America, to leave them alone in peace. And they practiced the art of survival by siding with whichever military force was present at a particular time, be it Viet Cong, North Vietnamese, or American. We found also that all too often American men were dying in those rice paddies for want of support from their allies. We saw firsthand how monies from American taxes was used for a corrupt dictatorial regime. We saw that many people in this country had a one-sided idea of who was kept free by our flag, as blacks provided the highest percentage of casualties. We saw Vietnam ravaged equally by American bombs, as well as by search and destroy missions, as well as by Viet Cong terrorism. And yet we listened while this country tried to blame all of the havoc on the Viet Cong. We rationalized destroying villages in order to save them. We saw America lose her sense of morality as she accepted very coolly a My Lai and refused to give up the image of American soldiers that hand out chocolate bars and chewing gum. We learned the meaning of free fire zones, shoot anything that moves, and we watched while America placed a cheapness on the lives of Orientals. We watched the United States' falsification of body counts, in fact, the glorification of body counts. We listened while month after month we were told the back of the enemy was about to break. We fought using weapons against Oriental human beings with quotation marks around that. We fought using weapons against those people which I do not believe this country would dream of using were we fighting in a European theater, or let us say a non-third world people theater. And so we watched while men charged up hills because a general said that hill has to be taken, and after losing one platoon or two platoons, they marched away to leave the hill for the reoccupation of the North Vietnamese. Because we watched pride allow the most unimportant of battles to be blown into extravaganzas. Because we couldn't lose, and we couldn't retreat, and because it didn't matter how many American bodies were lost to prove that point. And so there were Hamburger Hills and Caissons and Hill 881s and Firebase 6s and so many others. And now we're told that the men who fought there must watch quietly while American lives are lost so that we can exercise the incredible arrogance of Vietnamizing the Vietnamese.
Making a very significant statement, and don't let him proceed.
Each day to facilitate the process by which the United States washes her hands of Vietnam, someone has to give up his life, so that the United States doesn't have to admit something that the entire world already knows, so that we can't say that we've made a mistake. Someone has to die so that President Nixon won't be, and these are his words, the first president to lose a war. And we are asking Americans to think about that. Because how do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? But we're trying to do that. And we're doing it with thousands of rationalizations. And if you read carefully the president's last speech to the people of this country, You can see that he says and says clearly, but the issue, gentlemen, the issue is communism. And the question is whether or not we will leave that country to the communists or whether or not we will try to give it a hope to be a free people. But the point is they're not a free people now under us. They're not a free people. And we cannot fight communism all over the world, and I think we should have learned that lesson by now. But the problem of veterans goes beyond this personal problem. Because you think about a poster in this country with a picture of Uncle Sam, and the picture says, I want you. And a young man comes out of high school and says, that's fine, I'm going to serve my country. And he goes to Vietnam, and he shoots, and he kills, and he does his job. Or maybe he doesn't kill, maybe he just goes, and he comes back. And when he gets back to this country, he finds that he isn't really wanted. Because the largest unemployment figure in the country, it varies depending on who you get it from, the Veterans Administration, 15%, various other sources, 22%, but the largest figure of unemployed in this country are veterans of this war. And of those veterans, 33% of the unemployed are black. That means one out of every 10 of the nation's unemployed is a veteran of Vietnam. The hospitals across the country won't or can't meet their demands. It's not a question of not trying, they haven't got the appropriations. A man recently died after he had a tracheotomy in California. Not because of the operation, but because there wasn't enough personnel to clean the mucus out of his tube and he suffocated to death. Another young man just died in a New York VA hospital the other day. A friend of mine was lying in a bed two beds away and tried to help him. But he couldn't. They rang a bell, and there was no one there to service that man. And so he died of convulsions. 57%, I understand 57% of all those entering VA hospitals talk about suicide. And some 27% have tried. And they try because they come back to this country and they have to face what they did in Vietnam, and then they come back and find the indifference of a country that doesn't really care. That doesn't really care. And suddenly we're faced with a very sickening situation in this country because there's no moral indignation. And if there is, it comes from people who are almost exhausted by their past indignancies, and I know that many of them are sitting in front of me. The country seems to have lain down and accepted something as serious as Laos. Just as we calmly shrugged off the loss of 700,000 lives in Pakistan, the so-called greatest disaster of all times, we are here as veterans to say that we think we are in the midst of the greatest disaster of all times now, because they are still dying over there, and not just Americans, Vietnamese. And we are rationalizing leaving that country so that those people can go on killing each other for years to come. Americans seem to have accepted the idea that the war is winding down, at least for Americans. And they have also allowed the bodies, which were once used by a president for statistics to prove that we were winning this war, to be used as evidence against a man who followed orders and who interpreted those orders no differently than hundreds of other men in South Vietnam. We veterans can only look with amazement on the fact that this country has not been able to see that there's absolutely no difference between a ground troop and a helicopter crew. And yet people have accepted a differentiation fed them by the administration. No ground troops are in Laos, so it's all right to kill Laotians by remote control. But believe me, the helicopter crews fill the same body bags, and they wreak the same kind of damage on the Vietnamese and Laotian countryside as anyone else. And the president is talking about allowing that to go on for many years to come. And one can only ask if we will really be satisfied when the troops march into Hanoi. We are asking here in Washington for some action. Action from the Congress of the United States of America, which has the power to raise and maintain armies, and which by the Constitution also has the power to declare war. We've come here not to the president, because we believe that this body can be responsive to the will of the people, and we believe that the will of the people says that we should be out of Vietnam now. We're here in Washington also to say that the problem of this war is not just a question of war and diplomacy. It's part and parcel of everything that we are trying as human beings to communicate to people in this country. The question of racism, which is rampant in the military, and so many other questions also, the use of weapons, the hypocrisy, and our taking umbrage in the Geneva Conventions and using that as justification for a continuation of this war, when we are more guilty than any other body of violations of those Geneva Conventions, in the use of free fire zones, harassment interdiction fire, search and destroy missions, the bombings, the torture of prisoners, the killing of prisoners, accepted policy by many units in South Vietnam. That's what we're trying to say. It's part and parcel of everything. An American Indian friend of mine who lives on the Indian nation of Alcatraz put it to me very succinctly. He told me how as a boy on an Indian reservation he had watched television, and he used to cheer the cowboys when they came in and shot the Indians. And then suddenly one day he stopped in Vietnam and he said, "My God, I'm doing to these people the very same thing that was done to my people." And he stopped. And that's what we're trying to say, that we think this thing has to end. We're also here to ask, we're here to ask vehemently, where are the leaders of our country? Where is the leadership? We're here to ask, where are McNamara, Barstow, Bundy, Gilpatrick, and so many others? Where are they now that we, the men whom they sent off to war, have returned? These are commanders who have deserted their troops, and there is no more serious crime in the law of war. The Army says they never leave their wounded. The Marines say they never leave even their dead. These men have left all the casualties and retreated behind a pious shield of public rectitude. They've left the real stuff of their reputations bleaching behind them in the sun in this country. And finally, this administration has done us the ultimate dishonor. They have attempted to disown us and the sacrifices we made for this country. In their blindness and fear, they have tried to deny that we are veterans or that we served in Nam. We do not need their testimony. Our own scars and stumps of limbs are witness enough for others, and for ourselves, we wish that a merciful God could wipe away our own memories of that service as easily as this administration has wiped their memories of us. But all that they have done and all that they can do by this denial is to make more clear than ever our own determination to undertake one last mission, to search out and destroy the last vestige of this barbaric war, to pacify our own hearts, to conquer the hate and fear that have driven this country these last 10 years and more. And more. And so when 30 years from now our brothers go down the street without a leg, without an arm or a face, and small boys ask why, we will be able to say Vietnam, and not mean a desert, not a filthy, obscene memory, but mean instead the place where America finally turned, and where soldiers like us helped it in the turning. Thank you.